CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 64, with Dr. Gary Vortz, finding your perfect fit and keeping the counselor bag open.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest, someone who I first met, gosh, maybe 20 years ago, when neither of us had any gray hair. And that is Gary Vortz. Gary, welcome to our podcast.
Oh, thanks, Uday. It's so good to see you, and can't wait to share this conversation. So I really appreciate the opportunity.
Now, am I saying the name right? Vortz.
Vortz. That is correct. It gets butchered here in Kentucky. I'm commonly Dr. What's your name, or Dr. Vortz, or you're not Dr. Ferguson. Those are kind of the names I get called. But I'll answer anything. Just don't call me late to dinner.
There you go. Well, I like, now that you have that very ethnic spelling for your name,
yes,
you get the same questions I get, which is like, no, but where are you really from?
Yes, I do. I do. Patients actually think that I am an immigrant from some part of Eastern Europe or Germany. And they, they are very curious about that. But, you know, it's just how my name is spelled. And I'm just probably, you know, stubborn enough to keep the umlaut. So, you know, that's okay.
Hey, I like the two little dots.
It looks cool. Yeah, exactly. It gives it some flair.
That's awesome. Well, tell us about your path in ophthalmology. I first met you in an ASCRS meeting, just kind of out of the blue.
Come on,
20 years ago?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, so I went to medical school thinking I was going to be a trauma surgeon. I just wanted to get my hands busy, and I knew I wanted to do surgery of some sort. My dad's an internist, so I had to go a different direction. And, you know, as soon as I met some general surgeons and kind of got to see what that was like, I just was like, I don't think this is my deal. So I knew I wanted to do microsurgery. I was kind of between plastics and ophthalmology. And then I met Austin Paracha and saw him do a day of cataract surgery. And I was absolutely hooked. It was like love at first sight. It was the most, like, I don't think ASMR was even a thing back then. But to me, it was almost like I was in a trance. I saw a master at his craft. I saw, you know, an elegant surgeon or elegant surgery being done by a master surgeon. I could see exactly what was happening. And I just thought, my gosh, if I could do this every day the rest of my life, I would be the happiest person. And you know what? I'm so honored that I get that opportunity, and it still does not get old. It never gets old.
Well, that's the amazing part for both of us, right? I think you're an ultra high volume surgeon, and every case is still as exciting as one of the first cases.
Absolutely. And some days you want it to be a little boring, and you wish it were a little more boring than it is.
Right. After a certain age, we would say after age 50, I kind of like the routine cases.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
In fact, there's a longstanding tradition when the new young partner joins the practice who's like 33 years old, that's where all the 10 out of 10 difficulty cases go.
That's right. That's right. There's an old saying, was it say like there are brave pilots and old pilots, but no old brave pilots.
Right.
It's kind of like, you know, there are brave refractive surgeons and old refractive surgeons, but no old brave refractive surgeons, maybe something along those lines.
Yeah. You know, that's a good point. I mean, our appetite, let's say, for very challenging, in fact, high risk cases probably does decline with age.
Yeah. But also, you know, you've got some tricks up your sleeve.
Right.
And sometimes the things that are complex, they stimulate your mind. And as long as you're not knee deep in 30 more cases, you know, those can be fun. My partner sort of calls them surgical adventures. He doesn't mind doing the Yamani technique cases or the, you know, bad zonule cases every now and again. But I think you got to plan for them. It's just when they catch you by surprise,
that's the one.
A little tough.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. If I know if it's a very tough case and I add it on to the end of my day and there's nothing to follow, that's a different story than, like you said, finding out like in the middle of your lineup, surprise, the patient forgot to tell you about his or her car accident and the airbag injury.
Yeah. Well, the other day, you know, I'm doing cases and this 25-year-old patient comes in, severe rheumatologic issues. So we've been on steroids. And she had had a retinal detachment and it would never really healed. So she had a chronic RD in the other eye. So basically monocular.
Oh boy.
And from steroid use, she had a white cataract, just absolutely white, but you knew it was going to be liquid. Mm-hmm. So what was very interesting about this case was I actually went in and just did a I just sort of did two paracenteses, made a small little micro rexus, mm-hmm. and almost took out the entire cataract just with IA aspiration.
Nice.
Because it was all liquid. And yeah. then filled the bag up. It had to cut the rexus because there was fibrotic areas mm-hmm. of the capsule I couldn't tear. And, you know, it was really interesting because for the staff, you know, we see these things every now and again. You know, she walked in being led in by the hand because, or right. wheeled in. She couldn't ambulate. And in post-op, she was telling the staff that she hadn't seen her baby in a year and a half.
Oh, my goodness.
And how excited she was to be able to finally see, because she's seeing right after surgery. You know, she's seeing, well, talking about.
Hopefully she thought the baby was cute.
Well, I assume so. We didn't see that actual interaction, but I go out there and everyone's crying. I mean, my staff is crying. Like, they're like this. They're like, Dr. Wirtz, you know, this really drives home what we do.
Yeah,
you know, this lady's going to go home and see her child for the first time in a year and a half. And it just like makes you choke up. You know, we're delivering miracles at scale sometimes. You don't really sit back and think about it, but it's crazy what we get to do.
Yeah, especially with cataract. I mean, all of ophthalmology is amazing, but cataract for me as well was my first love. I knew I switched in med school. I wasn't going to do ophthalmology. I was doing something else. I switched in my fourth year of med school, the last minute ophthalmology, only because I happened to see a white cataract surgery being done.
Really?
And the same thing where the patient's like mind blown.
Yeah. They literally walk in or they can't even walk in and they can leave the hospital under their own power. And it is really a strange thing.
Yeah.
When you think about how much impact you can have on someone in a 10 to 15 minute procedure,
right.
You know, it's crazy. It's just it never gets old, honestly, just thinking about, you know, those patients. So, yeah.
Tell me about your path in ophthalmology.
You
were, before settling where you are now.
Yeah.
You had a little bit of an adventure.
Oh my gosh. It's been an adventure for sure. So, you know, I think one of the troubles with being, you know, an ophthalmologist is it's really hard to get in, right? So once you get in, you sort of think, well, if I could do this, I mean, I can do anything, right? I mean, I've done the hardest thing already. I got into ophthalmology residency. I passed my boards. I'm, you know, I feel like I'm pretty capable. A quick study at whatever I need to do. So, you know, the problem with that is sometimes you don't know what you don't know, you know, that black box of unknown. And so when I was finishing my residency, I got this opportunity with a high salary to go start a practice in a rural area in Kentucky. And I just thought to myself, well, what better way to serve the state, you know, to make some money, pay off some debts, and be my own boss? I've been chief resident. How much harder can it be to start a practice? And so I decided just... After I didn't do a fellowship. I just finished my chief year, which was, you know, PGY4. And the next day I went out and started practicing in Lebanon, Kentucky. If anyone ever has drank Maker's Mark, that's where Maker's Mark is basically distilled. It's Loretto, Kentucky, but it's like 10 minutes away. So I'm out in the middle of nowhere in Kentucky. And I realized pretty quickly that this hospital, they just wanted surgery in their hospital. They didn't super care about all the other things that go along with, you know, building an ophthalmology practice. How sustainable is it? And, you know, I probably wasn't also ready to do that, as it turns out. You know, there was a lot. I really went to school learning a lot about the management, the billing, the setting up of the office, procuring equipment, taking out loans, all these things that, you know, you don't really have a lot of training in. And as it turns out, I just wasn't so great at it. And, you know, after a year, I realized, okay, the hospital, the other people's money is about to run out. I'm going to have to figure out a way to keep the lights on because they're just not busy enough after a year. There wasn't enough demand. So, you know, I mean, do you want to hear the whole rest of this saga?
I'd love to.
Okay. All right. Well,
our listeners and viewers would too.
Okay. All right. Well, so I'm sitting here in Lebanon, Kentucky, twiddling my thumbs. It's about an hour from Louisville or an hour from Lexington. And I sit there and I think to myself, okay, I've got to be here for 5 more years. That's how the deal was. They basically, you know, owned my soul for 5 years because they put me up for a year. That was the deal. And I wasn't going to welch on the deal. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to figure something out. So I go to the hospital CEO and I say, look, I'm going to do all of the cataracts that this county and surrounding area can provide, but that's about one day's worth of work. And so, so long as I come and I operate and I do everything I need to do in this region at your hospital, I need to basically be able to go and feed my family the other 4 days a week or the other 3 days a week. And, you know, looking at the situation, he was reasonable. He's like, you know what, as long as you're, you know, taking care of the patients in Lebanon, the other time it really is yours to do what you want. So nice. I took a job in Maysville, Kentucky, which is an hour and a half the other way from where I live. So I live in Lexington. So I go up there and I'm working with a medical ophthalmologist who had a surgeon who retired. So I'm going up there doing surgery and seeing patients 2 days a week. I'm in Lebanon 2 days a week, essentially. And then one week out of the month, I took a locums job and I flew down to Florida. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you all, I'm sure we're all familiar with sugarcane. That was invented by a guy by the name of Joel Sugar. There's two Joel Sugars. I think one is at Michigan and the other Joel Sugar was down in the panhandle of Florida, in Perry, Florida. And he passed away very tragically at a young age in a parachuting accident. And so he was left with about a 78,000 square foot facility with no surgeon.
Wow.
And so I knew a guy who was working down there. He was a former UK resident also. He's like, hey, we need a surgeon. I'm like, well, I can do it, but I want to fly down, operate 5 days in a row, do all the surgery for a month in the week, and then fly back.
And how many cases is this? Hundreds.
It's be like 120, 100 and something cases. And I'm a year out of residency.
Nice. Well, okay. But look, we should say, though, you've always been incredibly talented surgically. I think when you were a resident, you won an award based on surgical skill, like a nationwide award.
Well, you know what?
You're very modest, but
you.
I know.
Thank you. I was very lucky to have good instructors. UK, shout out to University of Kentucky, Dr. Kapoor, Dr. Katz, you know, and all the rest of the faculty there. They were just so incredibly patient with me and gracious. And, you know, I got great training. And so part of being a good surgeon is people trusting you and, mm-hmm. you know, and investing their time with you. So, you know, it's because of that. But thank you. I do appreciate you mentioning
well,
that.
Well, you're out of training you know, now. Now you're cranking out 100 plus cases in a week, just pow.
Yeah, I was doing, I think I did 2,000 cases that second year. And
that's
so,
a good flip, yeah.
And so I'm doing surgery in Lebanon, I'm doing surgery in Maysville, I'm flying down. But, you know, that's not sustainable. That's what right. I call red line. You know, that's red line. You're going everywhere. You're driving an hour and a half one way. The next day, you're driving an hour the other way. You're trying to do surgery in multiple locations with different equipment, different
staff.
But
in your early 30s, though, you know,
yeah.
that's doable. Yeah. Because I also did 6 days a week in my early 30s.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, you know, I'm basically able to make it. I'm able to sort of scrape by, and I realize, okay, the Florida gig isn't gonna really, it's not sustainable. But I did that for 18 months. So I did that for a year and a half, and then I found another opportunity in Lexington where I was able to stay a little closer to home, and I just sort of started paring back the other things I was doing, you know, kind of getting closer to home, getting closer to doing what I wanted. I joined Paul Karpecki for 3 years. He and I were, you know, he and Bruce Koffler. So we were doing a lot of dry eye cornea stuff. I got to do some research, cool. Got to do some FDA research, PI stuff, and started doing some consulting and, you know, speaking. And that was kind of fun. I don't do as much of that anymore, but, you know, it's kind of a season for those sorts of things. And then ultimately, you know, my goal the whole time, people were probably thinking, what is this guy have no direction? Like, what is his problem? And I said that to myself a lot as well. Uh-huh. But I always had a goal. My goal always was to come back to Lexington and to join Lance Ferguson at Commonwealth Eye Surgery. That is a practice that is a regional referral center. And it was really, to me, like, the best possible job in ophthalmology. Mm-hmm. I saw that when I was a resident. His wife is the glaucoma attending, Sheila Sanders, who's amazing. And he always maintained a good relationship with the university. And so when we had free time, let's say, we could come over and observe him doing cataract surgery. We formed a friendship and, you know, I kind of intimated that, you know, if you get a little experience and get enough dirt under your fingernails, maybe someday there'll be an opportunity here for you. But, you know, I really had to sweat it out for about 6 or 7 years of just going, hitting the road, trying to, you know, trying my best to make a good name for myself.
Sure.
Winning over referrals and realizing it's not the first knock on the door that causes referral patterns to shake. It's about the 10th knock on the door. Uh-huh. It's trying your best to maintain, you know, keep your ego in check and just being there for your referring doctors and your patients. And that's how a reputation is built. You know, it just takes time. It takes so much time, but eventually I got the opportunity of a lifetime to join my partner 10 years ago. So 2014, I joined as the second surgeon at my partner at Commonwealth Eye Surgery, and I've been there ever since. And that's, you know, that's my sole job. And I'm really, really happy getting to do a lot of surgery and, you know, really helping to take care of the patients here in Kentucky.
Well, I think you brought up some great points, especially one that is, when I was a senior resident, I also said something very naive to myself. I've said a lot of dumb things in life. Believe me, I'm no genius. And one of those dumb things was when I was a senior resident, I was a month away from graduating, and I said to myself, can't wait till I'm in practice. It'll be so much easier than residency.
Yeah, that's what we think, right? We'll take the training wheels off, and then I'll really be able to ride the bike.
Right.
These training wheels are injuring me.
Go ahead.
I just said, you know, it's like taking the training wheels off. Like, it's these things that are they're hindering me from being able to ride my bike so well, you know?
Right.
Right.
And then also, how, especially in your early 30s, don't be afraid to just crank. Because oftentimes it's the seeds you plant in your early 30s, mid-30s, that grow the plants that you're going to reap the fruit from the rest of your career.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the thing that's interesting is, and I'm sure you get a lot of younger ophthalmologists who will reach out to you and say, hey, I've got a question, or, you know, I want some advice about a practice. And to be honest, I think that's one of the nicest things about ophthalmology is I don't think I've ever asked someone who is we're talking like the most senior KOLs, the leaders. Mm-hmm. I swear every single person in ophthalmology that I have ever asked for advice or help has been so gracious with their time has sat down with me. I mean, just more than I deserve. And so I've always have remembered that and appreciated it so much that anytime a younger doc wants to talk to me, I always carve out time to talk to him and try to listen and give them sage advice. But it's really interesting how a lot of doctors, they, I don't want to say that they expect to have everything right away. I don't think I don't think that's an unreasonable thing to expect, right? I mean, if you're dating somebody, you might say, well, I really hope this works out. I really hope this is my forever person. I don't think it's wrong to go into a practice thinking, right, man, I really want this to work out. But I almost think that it's almost inevitable, not always, but almost inevitable that the first practice you join, something's going to happen where either you change, the opportunity changes, life circumstances change, whatever,
right,
where you're going to probably go on from that practice. And that's okay. That's not a sign of failure. That's just a sign of growth and development.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I try
for sure
to tell people that.
Yeah, you know, for sure. It's like your first girlfriend or boyfriend. They may be amazing.
Right.
Not be the one that's forever. It's okay.
It's okay. It's not a sign. It's not that you're bad or they're bad or whatever, but you know, you don't stop growing at the end of residency. So even the things that might've been a perfect practice at the time you finish your residency, it may not be the perfect practice for you 5 years from now. And so that's okay.
Right. No, you gotta keep evolving. That's another important thing is, like you were saying as well, even on the consulting side, you do a lot less consulting now.
That's right.
And you now do more entrepreneurial ophthalmology businesses.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that also, I feel like there are seasons in an ophthalmologist's life. And some people, you know, they really enjoy the KOL thing and lecturing, and we're honored to have them. I mean, folks like you keep reinventing ways to educate us. And I'm like a, you know, I'm drinking from the fire hose from cataractcoach.com. Shout out, you know, like if you need advice on any cataract surgery, go to cataractcoach.com. I'll just plug it right here. It's amazing. And so if you find your lane and that's what really lights you up, I mean, that is amazing. Sure. But also I think you try some things over time and you find out, okay, do I like giving talks about pharmaceuticals? You know, like you listen to Bill Trattler or Laura Perriman or Jim Katz talk about pharmaceuticals, you think, man, like I could never do it as good as they do it. you know, right. Or do I like talking about devices and phaco machines or lenses? And, you know, you hear, you know, Sumitra Khandelwal, or you hear Uday, or you hear some of our other David Chang or Daniel Chang, either of them talk about IOLs. You think, man, I could never do it quite as good as they do it. But, you know, you find your way, and for me, part of that was, I don't know that I was really good at distilling down a whole lot of anything. But what I do like doing is I like asking questions. And so that's where I found some success, or not necessarily success, but I found enjoyment personally in starting a podcast. So 2016, we started Ophthalmology Off the Grid, got to interview a lot of people over the years, and I got to learn,
I've been on it. I had a great time.
Exactly.
I think twice.
Exactly. And I loved having you on. So it was a real honor. So that was really fun to do. And that was sort of a new thing back in 2016. But beyond that, yeah, I've started a couple of companies. One is Omega Ophthalmics, and we are still very excited about that technology. I also started a company with Priya Gupta called Arcua Innovations, where we have a formula for astigmatism correction below a diopter. So we don't want to do arcs for, if you can do a toric, we think you should always do a toric lens.
I'm with you.
But if you can't do a toric and you still have a little astigmatism, let's find a way to safely correct smaller amounts of astigmatism. And that's where the LRICalc.com came into play. So, yeah.
Awesome. Now, tell us more about Omega Ophthalmics. You got a lot of intellectual property and patents here.
Yeah, we've got over 80 patents and more pending. So that's been a huge, huge amount of work, but it's been a labor of love. And, you know, John Berdahl, a good friend of mine and good friend of, the ophthalmology in general, one of the most amazing guys you'll ever meet. He said, I early on back in the day, I asked him, I said, I got this idea. He's like, well, sleep on it for a couple of nights. He goes, if you can't not do it, then do it. But like, if you wake up in a couple of days from now, you think, I don't know, this is not the greatest idea. He's like, it's like sleep on it a couple of nights and see if it keeps you up. And this was just one of those ideas that just kind of kept me up at night. And the idea essentially is there's a major problem. There's a major issue with every cataract surgery that's such a problem. We don't even see it as a problem because we've accepted it as a reality. And that problem is the capsule collapses after cataract surgery.
Right.
I don't believe that the human lens capsule was ever supposed to collapse, right? And when it does collapse, what happens? It changes tissue structure. It changes from this nice, clear, elastic bag to this fibrotic tissue. It actually changes, it's called mesenchymal epithelial transformation. When the anterior and posterior leaflets touch, it starts fibrosing. And what does that do? Well, that causes, ultimately it can cause, PCO, intercapsular opacification, phimosis. But what it does is we have that beautiful inert space, and that potential space is lost forever because it envelops and encapsulates an IOL.
Right.
So my thought was, well, what if we could put a stent in there, kind of like a coronary artery, you put a stent in and you kind of regain the function of that artery. What if we put a stent like a donut inside of the capsule, and instead of basically giving up the capsular space, maintaining that space? And by doing so, we have the opportunity to innovate inside of an inert space where we have never been able to before. So you think about things like drug delivery. Mm. Well, the biggest problem with drug delivery is not the drug chemistry. It's where do you put the darn drug.
Right.
You put it in the anterior chamber, you just let it float around. Well, that's one idea. Do you put it subconj? Well, that can cause issues. We know about, subtenons and conjunctival drug delivery, not the greatest. You put it in the angle, that's what Glaukos is doing, and I applaud what they're doing. I think it's innovative, but ultimately, if I had to put drug, I may not want to put it in the angle, but I think it's okay what they're doing. Do you want to put it in the capsule? If you do, and you let the capsule collapse, well, how are you going to refill it? So you put it in the vitreous. Well, then now you've got retinal issues, you got floaters, et cetera. So what if you could put it behind the iris in the periphery of the capsular bag, but not interfering with the central 6 millimeters. And, we have enough volume in our device to put the equivalent of 70 years worth of Durysta just in the annulus of our device. Okay. So we could treat a patient for 70 years without ever having to refill that device. Now, there's some drug chemistry things, obviously, they have to work out. And I'm just saying in theory here.
Yeah.
So beyond that, though, we know when we talk to a patient, they're, none of them are really ready to make a decision about a lens until after surgery, because they don't know what it's really going to be like until they've tried it. And we get the occasional, I'm not saying it's everyone, maybe 1 or 2% of patients, where there's a mismatch between their brain or their eye and the IOL, right? And so every lens we put in, we know there's a chance one of those lenses is coming out.
Right.
And with the capsular collapse syndrome is what I'm calling it. You know, it's a time thing. You know, within 6 months, you've got a good shot at getting the lens out with really not much issue. But we're seeing patients a year, 2 years, 3 years down the road becomes more challenging, right? Less surgeons really want to do it because you have the collapse. We've done trials where we can take a lens out 2 years like it was put in yesterday.
Right, because your stent's keeping the bag open.
Exactly. There's no fibrosis. There's no fibrosis. Just switch it out. So we see that. We kind of think about that application of our device more like a seatbelt. We're not saying that everybody is going to need a lens exchange. Not a huge market for lens exchange, but you know, not a huge market for car crashes. But every time you roll out of your driveway, you're probably putting a seatbelt on because you know, in the event that something happens that you're not, you know, expecting, you're protected. And that's where we look at this idea of we should probably have every lens be exchangeable if need be, knowing that most of them are not going to ever need to be exchanged. So we're really looking at this device as a platform technology for both drug delivery, upgradable, exchangeable lenses, and then future applications that we can't even dream about right now. You know, like, but who thought about ChatGPT 5 years ago, right? But maybe we can put a pressure sensor in there. Maybe we can have other devices in there that actually can enhance human vision for low vision potential or other things. So we really are excited about it. There's a lot of momentum right now. I can't really get into, but we are really excited about what the next probably 6 to 12 months are going to bring for Omega.
Well, that is so exciting and so interesting. You have to think of it in a different term. I mean, I know from my work with the LensGen Juveen.
Right.
9 years ago, 2015, I did the first human implantations, and that's a big lens in two parts that keeps the bag fully open.
Right.
9 years later, it's a zero PCO rate.
Right. So just that insight alone, the human lens capsule should not collapse.
Right.
Whether you're doing accommodating IOLs or anything, we don't need to give up that space. It's too precious. And weird things happen to the capsule that we shouldn't accept as normal.
Right. Right. Well, I see a huge market. This is a fantastic idea. That is brilliant. See all that long driving from across Kentucky.
Right.
You sit in the car, you're thinking.
Exactly. Driving. Well, what's really sweet about it, and maybe one thing that's kind of always kept me inspired is I was at an ACOS meeting in 2011. It was in Orlando, and I brought the family. We're big Disney people, so I brought the family. And it was all about innovation. David Cox and the whole group were given this big series of talks about if you've got an idea, what do you do with it? So I was kind of primed, you know, you kind of start thinking, okay, well, maybe somebody will have an idea. And now I kind of know what to do with it. So I'm flying back and my daughter is asleep next to me in the plane. And it's just like this light bulb. I mean, have the whole idea just at once. It's just like, this is it. You know, in my mind, I'm not sure how everyone's mind works, but I sort of have this, I think I developed this in organic chemistry, you know, like thinking about things in three dimensions and like how they would move, how a device would move through in three dimensions and incision and how it would have to look and what it would have to do. And so I'm sort of like, I have this eureka moment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always told her that I'm like, you know, you were just sleeping right next to me on the plane ride back from Orlando and had this moment. So I don't know if you inspired me or what, but you were right there when this idea came in my head. And, you know, this year, I was able to give her, she's in optometry school at Ohio State. She just finished her first year of optometry school.
Awesome.
I was able to give her white coat at the white coat ceremony just a couple of weeks ago. So she's, I guess somehow it's rubbed off and she's going to, maybe I can recruit her someday to join the family business. So, but it's been a labor of love. It's something I'm super excited about. I've never lost my passion for it. And I'm really excited about the future. I'm also excited that my family is kind of wanting to maybe some way join the family biz.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, you know, another important point is I struggled in my early, mid, even late 30s in finding a good, like, family, like, work-life balance. I was terrible at it. And now you got a daughter who's in optometry school. Your son's off at university. You're glad you enjoyed when you did.
Well, that's the other thing, man. I mean, my wife and I this year are celebrating our 25th wedding anniversary. I'm 46, so do the math. I was 21 when we got married.
Wow.
And so we got married right before medical school. We had kids, you know, second year and fourth year of medical school. So, like, you know, in many ways, my kids have just grown up with me. You know, as I'm trying to grow up, they're growing up right next to me. And so, right. You know, if, you know, this is kind of their second run through university and medical school slash optometry school, right? Like, Peyton would be sitting there studying with me while I was studying, you know, studying for my boards, and she was in like third grade. So I was helping her with her algebra, you know, I was helping her with her math, and I'm studying for boards. It's, you know, it's crazy. Work-life balance is, you know, what I always just said is the only way I stayed balanced was I just kept spinning like a top. It was a centrifugal force that kept me upright. I just didn't stop moving.
So what's next for you? So obviously you're doing great things with Commonwealth Eye Surgery, keeping busy there surgically. You got Omega Ophthalmics going. You've got what else is keeping you busy? Because now that your kids are adults and on their own.
Yeah, well, I'm probably just trying to fight the neurotic voices in my head to say that you haven't done enough. Right? It's just hard. I think
we're all like that, though. Yeah.
You know, you'll never be good enough. You're never enough. It's, you got to do more. You got to do more. You need more.
We're all like that.
Right. The problem is to get to a certain point in your life, you have to be very motivated and you have to be on that grind. You're always grinding, always trying to like look for the next opportunity. But the problem with that is, you know, at some point you get there. And once you get there, that strategy no longer is really good at keeping you happy. Right. That strategy is good it's very motivating to get you kind of up the hill. But once you're kind of there, you know, you got to start looking around and thinking like, why did I do all this? You know, what's really important to me? Is it doing 1,000 more cataract surgeries a year? Or is it investing in the people around me? Is it trying to figure out how to slow down a little bit? Is it figuring out that life is more than just my work? And what is that more? I'm still trying to figure that out. But
I don't either.
Right? It's hard because we've poured so much of our souls into this that it is really difficult at some point to say, okay, what if I do want to slow down? Is that wrong? If I want to work 2 days a week, is that wrong to do that? If I want to, you know, take more time for my family and travel and those sorts of things, does that mean I'm, you know, wasting the things that I've developed? And so I'm trying to read more. I'm trying to be more introspective. I'm playing the guitar a little bit. I'm, you know, trying to work out more. We share that interest of, you know, trying to, you know, take care of ourselves. So I'm trying to do that. And ultimately I'm trying, and this probably sounds really lame and to anybody, you know, who would look up to someone in our status or in our category, it probably seems lame, but I'm trying to just realize that, you know, I'm not a human doing, I'm a human being. And sometimes just being is okay. You know, just being alone with my thoughts is okay. I don't have to think about the next surgery center, the next whatever. I just want to figure out how to be really good with where I'm at. And also I think a lot of that is like, how do I invest in other people? Because honestly, that to me, when I look at days where I'm really, really happy, it's I've either been with my buddies in ophthalmology where we've gotten to maybe not even talk about ophthalmology, but there's an unspoken level of like, you get me, you understand what it's like, you understand the pressures, you understand like all of it. So it's either one of those days or it's a day where I was able to invest in somebody. I was able to have a conversation with someone about, you know, they're younger and what they're looking for. I was able to, you know, connect people to opportunities, just nothing to do with me. But so I'm hoping to continue looking for opportunities to invest in people because that's what I really wanted when I was younger and I needed, I had some of that. And I really, it really helped me, you know, to have connections to people and who could speak some wisdom in my life. But, you know, a lot of it is honestly just realizing that I don't have to keep up the pace to be anything. You know, I'm okay. It's okay if I decide whatever I want to do, I can kind of own that. And just kind of sit with that a little bit.
I mean, I admire that because I'm not at that point. I'm just working so hard and doing so much. And then it's like, I can't even stop. I'm on the train now. And I can't get off the train.
It's hard, man. It's hard.
The only thing in my life that's kind of gotten me where I am is I've never been the smart kid in the class, but I'm the donkey who can work really hard. So give me an incredibly difficult assignment that no one else wants to do.
Right. I will do it.
Make a new video every day for 2,200 days in a row.
During a wildfire. Start it during a wildfire.
Right. Okay, I'll do it. That's all I know is how to work hard.
Exactly. And so there's so much value in that, right? Because think about all the lives you've touched.
Sometimes I'm like burned out. I'm like, when you're saying all this, I'm like, you said human being. It's okay for me to just be instead of having to go do, go, 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 run.
Right. Because at the end of our lives, you know, we're going to look back and we're going to, you know, we'll have some sort of assessment. And I think part of it will be, we'll be really, really proud of ourselves, hopefully.
Right.
We'll be able to look at all of the patients we've taken care of and all of the, I always think about the staff that I get to work with. I don't want to say that I get to work with me. I get to work with them. I love working with them. I love going to work and, you know, joking around with them and, you know, connect with them. And like, I just like, hopefully it will, my life, when I look back on it, I will have felt on some level that I've done a good job being a good person to the people that I work with, and that I've been compassionate to my patients, and I've done a really, really good job. Right. And that maybe I've, in some way, I left ophthalmology better than I found it. Honestly, Omega Ophthalmics, you know what? Like, I understand it's an investment, and there is like a whole part of a startup and a venture where you want your investors to make a return. And honestly, if anything keeps me up at night, it's really that. I really, you know, got a lot of friends who have real money in this. And that's like, they bet
that's
on
stress.
Me.
That's and, stress, buddy.
And I can never let them down. So if I'm tired, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I got to grind. Like for me, like on that level, like I have to, there's no question. But like, for me, it really is not about the money. And I don't mean this in any sort of way, like money is a great tool, but that's what it is. It's not the goal. It's a tool. Money is a tool. What I really want for Omega is I want to be able to use it. I want to be able to help ophthalmology in some way, shape, or form, like this profession that's given me everything. You know, like I'm almost getting emotional about it, but like this profession that's given me everything. You know, I just want to be able to like give one little thing back. You know, to be like this, awesome. You know, like hopefully I had this insight and I worked really hard. And I was really trying to like, not just for me, not about my ego or the money, but I want patients to be able to have this because I know it will make an impact. And so for me, it's a passion project. And you know, the definition of passion, suffering. If you look up the definition, right? The definition of passion, like the passion of the Christ, means the suffering of Christ.
Yeah.
You know, so when you have a passion project, what that means is you're willing to suffer to see it to fruition.
Oh yeah.
Right? Oof. So I know you feel that because it's not all the glory of it. There's a lot of stuff that goes on underneath.
Right.
You know, where you're sort of you know, people don't see that.
Well, then it's the input versus the output. People right. see the output. They right. don't understand how much huge mountains of input went into achieving right. the output.
Right. People are like, I want to be a cataract coach. Do you really?
I need a break. Someone. Let me recruit right. someone to like do a month or two or six for me.
Right. Stand in. Cataract assistant coach.
Well, hey, sometimes you need it. You need someone else to take over. I'm not opposed to it.
No, that's great. I would love to tell you about what I'm excited about the future. I am really, really excited about three things. Okay. Maybe four. One, I cannot believe how much better trifocal lenses have become in my lifetime as an ophthalmologist.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think they're all fantastic. Absolutely. All the technologies have gotten really, really good. And I used to be, I went through this whole metamorphosis, restore, resume all the, early generations, used them, didn't have a great result or great results overall, and abandoned them. And thanks to Symphony, I got back in the game. And Symphony sort of was like, okay, you actually have good quality of vision. There's some spider webs, whatever, but I kind of got back in the game. And then with the launch of Panoptics, I just have had such fantastic results. I just can't believe it, honestly. I even got my partner using it. He never implanted a diffractive multifocal ever. And he put one in his friend, and he's like, he went driving with him. He's like, what do you see? What do you see? Do you see halos? Are you bothered by glare? It's like, oh, it's not that bad at all. So number one, I can't believe how much better diffractive technology has gotten. So we've got, the Odyssey lens coming out from Johnson & Johnson. I want to be fair, to everyone. I think the Symphony OptiBlue, fantastic EDOF lens. I really love Panoptics, and there's other stuff coming out. So super, super impressed with what a trifocal lens can do. Never thought we'd see that. Number two, light adjustable lens. What are your thoughts on that, man? I'm having fantastic results with it. Like, absolutely, especially in the patients who are really kind of hard to please and rightfully so. They're paying a lot of money, and our vision, what's our vision worth? And Kanye West put an $800,000 titanium grill in his mouth. And that's just for chompers, right? Like, so.
Well, we always know. Listen, dentists are so much smarter than ophthalmologists. We know this. Because we've all had patients tell us, well, I can't do the cataract this month because I'm going to spend $6,000 on this one tooth.
Right. What is up with that?
You got 32 teeth. Or maybe if you had your wisdom out, 28 teeth.
I know. Think about that. What is wrong? Why is our value proposition of human sight? It's $400 to do a cataract,
craziness, crazy.
And right. So dentists, it would be great to have a dentist on as an ophthalmology podcast guest and just be like, how are you doing it? Tell us all your secrets. We need to know. But that being said, light adjustable lens, super excited about it. Really, really pumped. Other thing I'm really excited about is the Apthera lens. Have you had any use of the Apthera lens?
I put a good number in for the patient with complicated cornea, such as
15
and 28 cut RK, all the wild ones.
Yeah. I just am so excited to be able to finally have something for those highly aberrated corneas. We have patients, we all do, in our neck of the woods with the same kind of RK, hex K. My first one was a patient with 8 diopters of astigmatism, irregular astigmatism from an HSV scar.
Now, are you doing it in bilateral for anyone ever is one question. Now, second question is, are you doing it in just a normal eye for the sole purpose of giving the wider range?
So I've implanted one, so I don't want to overstate my experience, but the first case was fantastic. I've not implanted bilaterally, but I plan to for patients who have these highly aberrated corneas.
Yeah, I can get that.
So I think that's the case. I've not done it for the extended depth of focus yet. Yeah. I don't know that I will, but I think it's reasonable. I also think that with the LAL Plus and some other EDOF technologies like Symphony, OptiBlue, I think there's maybe some better trade-offs, but I'm open to learning because I've got a use case. I always like to build a beachhead. For using a lens, I start with what I think is the most obvious use case and then sort of expand from there. Yep. So, at first it's going to be the aberrated corneas and I'm going to see how I like it and how it works. And I'm going to use it bilaterally. I'm also going to be using it in combination with the LAL. So we're going to be splitting you know, splitting the power, putting the Apthera in the bag, and then putting the LAL on top, probably in the bag as well. They're different materials. And then being able to reduce the higher order aberrations with the pinhole and reduce, you know, tune up the refractive component with the light adjustable lens. So we've cool got some patients.
Cool idea. That we're gonna,
yeah.
That'd be a neat video.
Yeah. Yeah. Happy to share it. Happy to share it.
And what's the last thing you're excited about? What's number four?
Well, I just think that glaucoma, you know, continues. You know, I just didn't see this coming. MIGS, you know, is just evolving. I love Hydrus. I think all the MIGS devices are fantastic. I'm really a fan of Hydrus. I think the iDose thing that Glaukos is coming out with is really interesting. I plan to start using that soon. And Elios has a really interesting device. It's an excimer laser that actually is very Star Wars, right? It's like you got your lightsaber, you take it in the eye, just pew, 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 and you open up, you know, you open up the TM and you've got, you know, new outflow. And the data out of Europe is really, really interesting. I actually got to go to Panama a few months ago and do a couple of cases. And, you know, that technology is very interesting. You know, it never ceases to amaze me how we're finding new ways to solve old problems.
Yeah, I think a lot of neat stuff coming also down the pike. Absolutely. A lot of stuff coming our way. But yeah, for any of these things, I'd rather have more options. I want more tools in the toolbox. I'm the guy, even if I just have like my three or four favorite tools, I still want to have like 50 tools in the toolbox, just in case.
You have to have them, man. You never know when you're going to need them, honestly. I mean,
right. It's like you said, the small aperture lens is like, yeah, it's really, for certain cases, like a highly aberrated cornea, it's just the only game down.
Right. You're saving PK. I mean, you're saving people from dulks or penetrating keratoplasties in some cases. Right. You know, when you think about the quality of vision you're able to restore for them. I mean, this guy that I was taking care of with 8 diopters of irregular astigmatism, 20/20 uncorrected. Yeah, now, obviously, that's probably an outlier case, but I mean, he was thrilled. I made him wait a couple of years to get it. I'm like, you really need to hold off. And so he's just thrilled that he's got such good vision. So yeah, it's amazing to have these tools.
Yeah. The more tools, the better. Because obviously our ultimate goal is to tailor the surgery to the specific patient and that specific eye. And then the more tools we got, the better we're able to achieve that.
Right. Someday we're going to be either like 3D printing lenses in the OR at the time of surgery based on, you know, intraoperative aberrometry, or we're going to have, you know, more advanced, every lens will be adjustable in the future. You'll probably have robotic surgery at some point where, that's coming. That's pretty much already here. So
I'm already working with a company.
I believe it. I've heard of a couple of them. So I would love, actually, just between you and me, I'm sure no one's listening to this, but I would love to see that technology. It's very interesting to me. I worry a little bit about our job security, but you know what? We always have to think about the bigger picture. Cataract surgery, you know, cataracts are the number one cause of reversible blindness in the world.
Right.
There is no shame in trying to scale that technology so that people around the world don't have to be blind.
Right.
You know, well, like that's, you know, what this means.
For sure. And really, if I put it to you in a different way, how automated is LASIK already?
Yeah.
You get the patient, femtosecond laser makes you flap. What do you actually do? You lift the flap. Okay. The excimer does the entire ablation. What do you do now? You put the flap down, you squirt some PSS on. That's easily automated.
No, so what I do is I tell the patient, you're going to feel a little pressure. All right, here, vision's going to black out. All right. I'm a narrator. I'm basically just narrating, you know, as the robots are doing it, you know, but I'm trying to keep them calm. So, you know, I guess if I've got that skill, it will translate as the robots continue to take over for us.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we get robotic cataract surgery, I think the nice part will be able to have a surgeon, single surgeon, supervise, let's say, 4 robotic screens at once. And they're going, okay, they just let it continue. Otherwise, you can hit pause and stop one or the other, et cetera. I think you'll kind of get to that. But the other option, too, is I just came back from Brazil, in Rio, the Brazilian Cataract Refractive Meeting. These are some unbelievably talented surgeons. If I tell you some straight numbers, you'll be blown away.
Listen to me. Your last video that you posted, the 2-minute cataract surgery, it really messed me up. Like my staff is very upset with you that you showed me that video because I'm like, I have to figure this out. I have to figure out how he did it. 2 minutes. You know, I cannot believe it. So tell me about maybe the world's most talented group of surgeons down in Brazil.
Well, you know, the amazing part is because they're doing the public health system where there's an immense backlog. Brazil has a population of 200 million, huge population and a big backlog and incredibly talented surgeons. I met multiple surgeons who do 2,000 to 3,000 cataracts a month. Not a typo, a month. And many surgeons who do 100 cataracts in a day or more, one OR.
I'm going to have to go see it. I need to schedule a trip. I can't believe it. I just, my mind cannot wrap around.
I have videos of it already on Cataract Coach to show not just the microscope view, but also the OR view to see what's happening. But there are, you know, sometimes putting two patients in the same room, operating on one while the other's getting prepped, et cetera. But the amazing part is they're delivering basically, you get people who are essentially blinded, you know, 2,200 cataracts or worse. And these patients are just like, yeah, had a 2-3 minute procedure. Pow, there's your vision. Enjoy. Next.
Are they doing phacos or are they doing M6?
No, this is phaco. This is a beautiful surgery.
I'm sure it is.
But then I watch those surgeons. I think, you know what? Wow, they're incredibly talented. And like, I am not that good. Those guys are just
Let me ask this. How do they feel at the end of 100 surgery day? How are they mentally and physically doing? Are they okay? Are the guys okay down there? No, should we even pray for them?
They're great. But you know, what's interesting is like they'll talk about they have like 2 days a week of the private patients, 3 days a week of the public health system patients. And so the private patients, they operate a little differently, where it's a little bit more meticulous about, you know, capsule cleanup, more meticulous about the rexus or this.
Right.
And then whereas the one where they just kind of get through volume, it's a little different. Like in that case we're talking about, that surgeon basically is rotating the nucleus so many times, it frees up all the cortex. So you take out the nucleus and all the cortex with just the phago probe.
Right.
And then you don't even need an IA probe. Then you use hydro implantation, implant the lens.
Right.
See the incision, you're done.
Right. Yeah, exactly. When I do that though, honestly, when I hydro dissect, if I'm trying to get cortex cleaved, I'm left with all these little fibers. I don't like that. Sometimes takes more time for me to clean up those little individual strands than it does if I just do a regular hydro dissection and clean the cortex up. So I see what you're saying. Maybe if you're like, well, you know, not that big of a deal. But I mean, there's so much talent down there. I really want to go down there for a week or a month and just operate next to those guys and be like, tell me how to get better. I always want to get better. That's the thing. I do, you know, volume is volume, whatever. I want to get better every day. That is one thing I will say. I get up and every morning, I'm just thinking, I do want to improve a little bit. I want to figure out how to make myself just 1% better. So I would love doing something like that.
Oh, the meeting I just went to was the BRASCRS, Brazilian Association of Cataract Refractive Surgery. So ASCRS for Brazil version.
Yeah.
Go next year. It'll be next year in May.
Fantastic. I'll be there.
Meeting.
I'll be there. I'll just pay my due. I'll pay my entrance fee and I'll sit in the back, but I'm going to be there because I can't wait to see it.
No, and we can certainly connect you with some of these amazing surgeons. Go visit them, watch how it's done. Maybe if you're lucky, get a little coaching.
I'd love it. I would love it. That would be amazing. That would be absolutely amazing.
But yeah, it's what you said, though. I think we both have that. We strive to be better and better and better. Like, what can I do better on every case?
Right.
I'm so crazy. I compete with myself now. When I do that Rexus, my new challenge these days as I do with Rexus is when I see the patient post-op, I don't want you to be able to tell where the Rexus started or stopped. I don't want that.
You don't want the little heart? I don't want the little widow's peak thing.
No. I don't want the widow's peak. It'd be such a perfect circle. You can't tell where it started. That's what I want.
Well, my challenge is to see how many Rexus, manual Rexuses in a row I can get perfect 360 degree overlap with. So I mark every cornea with a 5 millimeter marker so that I can trace it. And it's made such a difference in terms of not refractive results, but my own OCD. I love the way the IOL looks when it's perfectly centered. And I always put the haptics in the exact same location, 6 and 12. It's just my signature. I always want it to look like a, you know, just absolutely perfect. I don't want the haptics wonky. Now, obviously, toric is different, but for a monofocal lens standard case, I want 360 overlap, haptics north and south.
For sure.
Boom.
Well, I just have forceps that are marked off at 2.5 and 5 millimeters. So as I tear it, I can kind of measure it. I had a patient recently. I did this surgery, and I sent it back to the glaucoma specialist. And she said to me, she's like, "Oh, the femto rexus looks great." And I was like, "Oh no, that's not femto. That's forceps."
That's all. That's the highest compliment you can get right there.
So it's fun. That's good. Well, I think we all have that passion.
Yeah.
Really neat stuff here. So I loved your path in ophthalmology. I think a good take-home point for young ophthalmologists, if you're in your 30s, even your 40s, it's okay. You're going to change gears.
Yep.
Situations may shift a little bit. It's okay. It'll all work out.
Exactly. Just keep following your passion. Listen to those voices, you know, that kind of guide you of, you know, where you're going right, maybe where you can improve. And don't be so hard on yourself.
Yeah, I think we're all very tough critics of ourselves. Another great important lesson from you was you have a great idea. I loved the saying here, which was see if you cannot do it.
Try not to do it. If
you can't not do it, then it's probably a great idea. And then the other thing too is like, take it from a guy who has 80 patents, lock up your IP.
Yes, lock up your IP. Absolutely, absolutely right. That's a good summary. Thank you so much for having me, man. It's been a real honor.
My pleasure. Always a great time talking to you. And we will put your name there correctly with the umlaut, the two dots over the outs.
Wurz. You got it. Thanks, Uday. Right, take care.
Thank you. And I want to remind our viewers and listeners, remember, every single week we got a brand new podcast. Always great stuff. We're on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, YouTube, anywhere you find your podcast, you're going to find Cataract Coach. We're still doing a new Cataract Coach video every single day. 2,200 plus videos and counting. And tomorrow's video on cataractcoach.com is going to be Dr. Wurz. And he sent us a beautiful video, and we'll show it to you tomorrow. Until next time.